Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the October 5th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a whole sea of women. They're standing with their arms crossed, three in the foreground in different colored shirts, red, blue, yellow, different ethnicities, different sort of expressions on their faces. As I said, all women and all looking directly into the reader, and it says, "Silent no more. Why women are often afraid to report sexual assaults." And we picked that up as the controversy of the week, but first main story is certainly related. Kavanaugh digs in amid new accusations. What happened? Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh denied new allegations of sexual misconduct this week as the Senate prepared to hear testimony from Christine Blasey Ford, a California psychologist who said the judge assaulted her in high school. Julie Swetnick, a 55-year-old technologist from Washington, D.C., who has had security clearances from several government agencies, said that she was gang raped in 1982 at a high school party attended by Kavanaugh. Swetnick did not accuse Kavanaugh of raping her, but in a sworn declaration released by her attorney, Michael Avenatti, who also represents adult film star Stormy Daniels against President Trump, Swetnick said that she attended at least 10 house parties with Kavanaugh in the Washington suburbs from 1981 to 1983, and that the teenage Kavanaugh was a mean drunk who became abusive toward girls, touching and grinding against them without their consent. She said she remembers seeing Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge spike punch with alcohol and drugs while targeting women for train rapes, and seeing the two lined up with older boys outside a room at a party waiting for their turn with an inebriated girl. Kavanaugh adamantly denied the accusations, calling them ridiculous and from the Twilight Zone. Swetnick's accusation came just days after another woman, Deborah Ramirez, told The New Yorker that Kavanaugh exposed himself to her during a drunken dorm party at Yale. Kavanaugh denied that story as well, calling it a smear, plain and simple. Appearing with his wife on Fox News, the first time a Supreme Court nominee has given a pre-confirmation television interview, Kavanaugh reiterated that he has never assaulted anyone. "I've always treated women with dignity and respect," Kavanaugh said, adding that he didn't lose his virginity until many years after high school. The Senate Judiciary Committee was slated to hear testimony from both Kavanaugh and Blasey after the week went to press. The 10 Democrats on the committee called for Kavanaugh to withdraw after the three women made their allegations, but the 11 Republicans on the committee said they would press on with a vote over whether to send Kavanaugh's confirmation to the full Senate. What the editorial said: "Republicans should fight tooth and nail for Kavanaugh," said the National Review. "The new allegations have all the hallmarks of a partisan hit job." Ramirez admits that she hesitated to come forward because there were such large gaps in her memory, and her story hasn't been corroborated by eyewitnesses, only people who heard about the event after the fact. Blasey's story is also uncorroborated and suspiciously vague. If Democrats succeed in taking down Kavanaugh with these flimsy charges, it will be a smashing victory for garbage pail politics. If you want to prove Kavanaugh's innocence, call in the FBI, said the Washington Post. A full investigation of all these allegations would reassure the public that senators are doing their due diligence. Nevertheless, Republicans have refused an FBI inquiry in their effort to rush Kavanaugh onto the court. Why the rush? What the columnist said. The smear campaign against Kavanaugh is truly evil, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com. Democrats will stop at nothing to keep conservatives from gaining a solid majority on the Supreme Court, even if it means assassinating the character of a man who has spent his entire life in public service. The idea that the country should convict him and destroy his life with no evidence other than recovered and uncorroborated memories and creepy porn lawyer Michael Avenatti's say-so is quite insane. Sorry, but how can we trust anything Kavanaugh says? Asks Lily Loofborough in Slate.com. The judge's depiction of himself as a virginal, pious choir boy who occasionally had a few too many beers doesn't square with what we've heard from several high school and college classmates who describe him as a hard and belligerent drinker. His yearbook contains references to binge drinking, as well as crude jokes about a woman named Renata Schroeder Dauphin, with Kavanaugh and his buddies referring to themselves as Renata alumni. To put it bluntly, Kavanaugh is a phony and a liar, which is disqualifying in itself. He has acted like a guilty man trying to hide something, said Andrew Cohen in NewRepublic.com. The judge has been huddling with the Trump administration for strategy sessions all week, being coached on how to deny the allegations without alienating Republican women before the midterms. Given that Kavanaugh could be hearing vital cases concerning this White House within weeks, that's a conflict of interest and proof that he's unworthy of the job for which he is nominated. The ugly fight over Kavanaugh proves once again our system is broken, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. In America's stark partisan binary, Kavanaugh is either a perfect exemplar of judicial expertise and impeccable moral conduct, or he is a lying rapist determined to destroy and control the lives of all women. Our institutions can't survive this anything-goes tribalism for long. In such a civil war, the idea that the Supreme Court could ever perform the role it was designed to, interpret the law in a non-tribal way, is laughable. We'll go ahead and read the second main story this week, titled Trump Blasts Globalism, Iran at UN. What happened? President Trump launched a fierce attack on the ideology of globalism in a speech to the United Nations General Assembly this week, declaring that he would not allow America's sovereignty to be impinged upon by any multinational institution. In a 35-minute address to more than 100 world leaders, Trump slammed the World Trade Organization, the UN Human Rights Council, OPEC, and the International Criminal Court for seeking to constrain the U.S. America will always choose independence and cooperation, he said, over global governments, control, and domination. He singled out Iran as an international bad actor, blaming the country's corrupt dictatorship for fueling the Syrian civil war and spreading chaos, death, and destruction across the Middle East. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani shot back in his own General Assembly address, saying Trump has had xenophobic tendencies resembling a Nazi disposition. Trump had kinder words for North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, whom he branded Little Rocket Man at last year's General Assembly. hailing the tyrant's courage for holding direct peace talks with him. Trump told world leaders that rapprochement with North Korea was just one of his many achievements, and that his administration had accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. The boast was met with laughter from the audience. "It's the first time I'm aware of," said Thomas Wright, an analyst at the Brookings Institution, "that people actually laughed at a president." In a later UN session, Trump accused Beijing of attempting to interfere against Republicans in the November midterms because of his tough stance on trade. What the editorials said: "This was a sustained attack on globalism," said USA Today. "Trump depicts a brutalist world where the U.S. is played for a sucker. But problems like climate disruption, terrorism, the spread of nuclear weapons, trade disputes, and flows of refugees can only be solved by international cooperation." Trump's version of America First isolationism plays well with his base, but whether it is producing a safer and better world is highly doubtful. "Trump isn't an isolationist," said the Washington Examiner. "He simply believes that the U.S. should make decisions based on American rights and interests, full stop. When we have mutual interests, of course, we will work with other nations. But the U.S. shouldn't have to be the world's policeman, nor should we be subject to spurious prosecutions by the International Criminal Court." His detractors will never admit it, but his UN speech proves that Trump has a coherent view of the world. What the columnist said: "For years, Trump claimed that the world was laughing at the U.S., said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. "He insists the snickering stopped the moment he took office and got tough on immigration and trade. But now he has literally been laughed at on the world stage, his personal nightmare. Perhaps there is a silver lining, though. Our allies might say they can no longer rely on Washington, and our soft power is at its lowest ebb since World War II. But America can still unite the global community, if only it in giggles. The globalists can laugh all they want, but Trump is winning," said Benny Avni in the New York Post. "Since taking office, he's pulled the U.S. out of numerous flawed international pacts, most notably the 2015 Iran nuclear deal that let Tehran export oil and use profits to fuel its Middle East adventurism. Trump aims to bend Iran with powerful sanctions, an American First approach that's more promising than the oh-so-united Iran coddling of former President Barack Obama and European leaders. Trump sees America's role in the world as a bully, not a beacon," said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post. "He threatened not to defend OPEC member countries if they do not lower their oil prices, and argued foreign aid should be based on what is offered in return. This is an extremely self-interested form of nationalism, inspired by a dark vision of an America that is under siege by the rest of the world. But there is a danger in rejecting globalization, because others will not. As the U.S. withdraws from the international order, China stands ready to move into the vacuum." And our controversy of the week, as related to the cover drawing, is titled "Sexual Assault: Why Women Don't Report." President Trump tweeted last week that if Brett Kavanaugh really assaulted Christine Blasey Ford in 1982, why weren't charges immediately filed with local law enforcement authorities? "Like so many other women, I can tell you why," said Leslie Marshall in FoxNews.com. "On my 18th birthday, as a college freshman, I was the victim of an attack quite similar to the one Blasey describes, and I kept silent. Why? In a word, fear. Fear of retaliation from my attacker, or ostracism by my peers, fearing of having my name dragged through the mud by defense lawyers, fear, above all, of being disbelieved and blamed for my own assault. It took me 30 years to tell anyone about being sexually assaulted as a teenager, said actress Alyssa Milano in Vox.com. But Trump's chilling comment has me compelled to speak up. In a necessary sequel to last year's Me Too movement, I and more than 700,000 victims of sexual harassment and abuse took to social media last week using the hashtag #WhyIDidn'tReport to explain why so many of us have carried the burden of being a survivor in silence. Among the legion who've come forward, author Diane Chamberlain, actress and TV host Padma Lakshmi, actress Lily Reinhart, actress Ashley Judd, and Ronald Reagan's daughter, Patty Davis. I did report and wound up regretting it despite doing everything right, said Danielle Campo-Amor and Marie Claire. I went straight to the police, submitted to an intrusive medical examination, and agreed to relive my trauma over and over again while skeptical police investigators grilled me on my alcohol consumption, what I'd been wearing, and my sexual history. Then the district attorney declined to press charges for lack of evidence. This is the tragic norm in America, said German Lopez in Vox.com. For every 1,000 rapes, only 310 are ever reported to the police, and just 6 result in conviction and imprisonment. Is it any wonder that women are skeptical of coming forward, knowing that 994 times in 1,000, the attacker is going to walk free? What police and juries often don't understand, said Amelia McDonald Perry in Rolling Stone, is that women who are assaulted sometimes don't have clear, specific memories of the event. At times of great trauma, the brain enters survival mode, etching a few sensory details indelibly into memory while screening out peripheral details like time and place. That was my experience, said Patty Davis in the Washington Post. 40 years after a music executive raped me in his office, I can vividly recall the smell of his breath, coffee, and stale bread. But I couldn't tell you or a jury what mouth it happened to or what he said to me before or afterwards, what month it happened or what he said to me before or afterward. The message of why I didn't report isn't that all allegations are automatically true, said Rachel Sklar in CNN.com. Our goal is to show our country how shockingly, terribly normal it is for women and men to be sexually assaulted. We're asking that instead of reflexively disbelieving women with claims of assault, people treat their stories seriously on the way to seeking the truth. That's an entirely fair request, said William Galston in the Wall Street Journal. Because of the fearful silence of victims, most men had no idea of the scale of the sexual abuse in our supposedly civilized society. We should seize this moment and start creating a culture in which the survivors of harassment and abuse feel safer and freer to tell their stories so that men can no longer assault women with impunity. In our good week, bad week feature, turns out it was a good week for bugging suspects after a Wisconsin man fleeing police on foot surrendered because he was being badly bitten by a swarm of mosquitoes. When we handcuffed him, he asked us to wipe his forehead because he had 15 to 20 mosquitoes on his forehead, said an officer. It was a good week for Scrabble players after Merriam-Webster has agreed to add the two-letter word EW to the latest edition of the official Scrabble Players Dictionary. Also added was the word OK, which lexicographer Peter Sokolowski said is something Scrabble players have been waiting for for a long time. And it was a good week for vague rebranding, with news that Dunkin' Donuts is to drop the word donuts from its name, only days after Weight Watchers announced that it was changing its name to WW, in which neither of the W's stand for anything in particular. But it was a bad week for Heathers, with new research indicating that the girl's name, Heather, has fallen out of fashion faster than any name in history. Just 219 babies were named Heather in 2017, down from more than 24,000 in 1975. It was a bad week for Europe, where French fries are projected to be an inch shorter this year after summer heat waves led to a harvest of undersized potatoes. This year, said Pierre Lebrun of Belgium's Walloon Potato Growers Association, we will all eat smaller fries. And it was a bad week for Luc Annis, a Belgian politician whose election ads were banned from Facebook owing to his unusual last name. Facebook just does not accept my name, said Annis, 26. Annis is now campaigning under the name Luc Anou. And a boring but important item while we're on this page, preventing a shutdown. Congress approved a spending package this week to avert a government shutdown ahead of the midterm elections. The $855 billion spending package, which would fund the federal government through December 7th, does not include money for a U.S.-Mexico border wall, a key sticking point for President Trump. He had demanded at least $5 billion, tweeting, "Where is the money for border security and the wall in this ridiculous spending bill? And where will it come from after the midterms?" Congressional Republicans, however, feared disastrous political fallout from a shutdown. While the bipartisan bill assures a short detente, Washington is resigned to a winter shutdown. The December end date will leave time for high-stakes negotiations before Christmas. Our briefing page article this week is titled, "The Immigration Enforcers." Critics charge that ICE is out of control under President Trump. Has the federal agency always been so controversial? Why was ICE created? For most of the 20th century, a single federal agency, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, was responsible for both legal immigration and enforcement against illegal immigration. Deporting undocumented immigrants was part of the agency's job, but only a small one. The 9/11 attacks carried out by terrorists who entered the country legally led many politicians to argue that INS wasn't up to the task and that immigration rules needed to be more strictly enforced. So in 2003, the federal immigration bureaucracy was integrated into the new Department of Homeland Security and split into three agencies. Legal immigration would be handled by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, border enforcement by Customs and Border Protection, and the enforcement of immigration law inside the U.S. by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, I-C-E. The agency set as its goal a 100% rate of removal for all removable aliens, a category that encompasses more than 11 million people, including those who have crossed the border illegally or overstayed their visa, and lawful resident immigrants who have committed a felony. Did deportations increase? Yes. Under President George W. Bush, the number of undocumented immigrants apprehended inside the U.S. surged from 115,000 in 1998 to 320,000 in 2008. That year, nearly two-thirds of the 369,000 aliens deported had been caught inside the U.S. ICE was able to boost those numbers by cooperating more with local law enforcement, which began passing custody of jailed undocumented immigrants to the agency, and cranking up raids on homes and workplaces. Arrests of workers solely for being in the country illegally went from 445 in 2003 to 3,667 in 2006. Gone are the days where individuals will find a haven here, ICE spokesman Greg Palmore said in 2007. The crackdown continued under President Barack Obama, nicknamed Deporter-in-Chief by critics, with ICE arrests peaking at more than 300,000 annually in 2010 and 2011, and deportations from the U.S. interior topping 200,000 in both years. Those numbers dropped after Obama ordered ICE in 2014 to focus on serious criminals. Still, the agency continued to expand. As of 2016, it had a budget of $6.1 billion, nearly double its 2003 level, and some 8,000 agents. What's happened under Trump? Trump came into office promising a zero-tolerance immigration regime. If you're in this country illegally, ICE Acting Director Thomas Homan said in 2017, you should look over your shoulder. Yet during Trump's first year in office, ICE arrested only 143,000 people and removed just over 61,000, far fewer than in Obama's peak years. The Migration Policy Institute says the agency has been thwarted by states and cities that have adopted sanctuary policies, which limit cooperation between authorities and immigration enforcement. Yet activists say that undocumented immigrants' fear of ICE has increased under Trump because the agency has become much less discriminating in its targets. Arrests of undocumented immigrants with no criminal record tripled in Trump's first 14 months to 58,010, compared with Obama's last 14 months. Over the same period, arrests of undocumented immigrants with criminal records climbed only 18%. How does ICE find undocumented immigrants? Agents are often guided by tip-offs. Employees of the Motel 6 franchise chain in Arizona and Washington State last year told reporters they routinely gave ICE guests private information, names, birth dates, license plate numbers. Those reports led to at least 26 arrests. ICE has also arrested undocumented immigrants as they attend court hearings, including one woman in Texas who was seeking a protective order against an abusive ex-boyfriend, and by carrying out sweeps in areas with large immigrant populations. The agency is pursuing any undocumented immigrant they can get their hands on, said David Leopold, former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Common sense and common decency be damned. What happens after a raid? While awaiting a hearing, undocumented immigrants are held in prison-like ICE detention centers. Physical and sexual abuse is common in the facilities, activists say, and food and medical care are often inadequate. Since 2010, 74 people have died in the centers, including 12 in 2017. ICE insists it takes seriously the welfare of all detainees. The alleged abuses and tales of family being separated as a result of raids have turned Abolish ICE into a rallying cry for the left. ICE has become a deportation force, said Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat from New York. That's why I believe we should get rid of it. Is that likely to happen? No. The Trump administration says ICE is vital to national security. The agency's workers are American heroes, Vice President Mike Pence said, who have played a critical role in ensuring that no major terrorist attack occurs on our shores. Most voters agree that ICE is needed. Only 25% want to scrap the agency, according to a JulyPolitico.com poll. Former Obama immigration advisor Cecilia Munoz says activists need to accept that immigration enforcement is a reality and focus on reforming ICE. Abolishing ICE sounds very close to saying, well, maybe we don't need a border, she says. I don't believe that's where this country is. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week. The first from the U.S., titled Yemen, America's Dirtiest War. Unlawful, unpopular, inhumane. That, said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com, is the only way to describe U.S. participation in Saudi Arabia's brutal war with Yemen. Under a program begun by President Obama and ratcheted up by President Trump, the U.S. is supplying weapons and military personnel to support the Saudis' bombing and blockade of Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. The U.N. says the Saudis' campaign has killed 16,000 civilians and put 8 million at the risk of starvation. From the 155 people killed by a Saudi airstrike on a Yemeni funeral hall in 2016 to the 50 children killed in a school bus in August, our weapons have made the U.S. complicit in the grisly deaths of the innocents. Congress has never given approval for U.S. involvement, and polling shows a majority of Americans oppose our sending weapons to the Saudis. So why do we continue? Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has told Congress that pulling U.S. military support would jeopardize a $2 billion weapons deal with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf allies. Trump was elected on an America First promise to get America out of messy foreign conflicts, but as president, he seems inclined to continue the same behavior with less shame and more callousness. This is a shorter, almost an extended quote from a little box they have called Viewpoint. This is a quote from Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. He says, there is a strong current of dehumanization running in our politics. The rival crew, it turns out, is not only wrong, but evil. And how can mortal enemies embrace the give and take of a shared political project? Only the raw exercise of power can decide between them. The goal is no longer to win arguments, but to crush opposition. This is not politics as usual. It is political pyromania. Our democracy is designed for disagreement. It is broken by mutual contempt. And we'll move from that to a column from France. Why schools should teach Arabic. Offering Arabic as a foreign language in more of our schools is the best way to integrate our Muslim population, said former French Minister of Culture Jack Lang. Conservatives have decried a proposal by Education Minister Jean-Michel Blanquer to revive the teaching of Arabic, calling it a capitulation to Islamist and arguing that exposing our nation's children to Arabic would open a way to the creeping Islamization of society. In fact, the opposite is true. If we allow the language of the Quran to be taught only by Islamist organizations run by incendiary imams, then French Muslims will be susceptible to dangerous radicalization. If, by contrast, we expand the teaching of Arabic in public schools, we'll create the conditions for a curriculum that corresponds with the principle of secularism and hence with the values of the French Republic. Right now, a mere 1 in 1,000 elementary school students and just 2 in 1,000 college students study Arabic. Yet French is a primary foreign language in the Arab world, particularly in North Africa and the Middle East. Because the Arab world is such an important economic and political partner, it is in France's interest to deepen this relationship by encouraging the teaching of Arabic. And this comes from Colombia. Rumors of war with Venezuela. Our government is giving contradictory and worrisome signs that it is contemplating war with Venezuela, said Patricia Lara Salive. Colombia's neighbor has been suffering from a humanitarian catastrophe with hyperinflation and shortages of food and medicine that have forced more than 1.5 million Venezuelans to flee, most of them to Colombia. During a visit last week to our border with Venezuela, Luis Almagro, Secretary General of the Organization of American States, accused Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro of crimes against humanity and said a military intervention might be needed. Colombian Foreign Minister Carlos Holmes Trujillo, who was standing right there, raised no protest. And later, our ambassador to the U.S., Francisco Santos, said that all options were under consideration. Colombian President Iván Duque insists his administration is not warmongering, but how else can you explain this behavior? Either Duque is secretly sponsoring a gringo military intervention in Venezuela, or his officials don't know what his policy is. A war with socialist Venezuela could send a flood of refugees here and likely restart Colombia's just-ended civil war with its own leftist radicals. Colombians need clarity, decisiveness, and leadership, President Duque. On to the last word feature, our in-depth article. The title this week, The Crane Who Fell in Love with a Human. The world population of white-naped cranes is falling fast, said Sadie Dingfelder. To get one to breed in captivity, a human handler had to seduce her. Early one summer morning, as rain is misting the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, a middle-aged man is courting a crane. Chris Crow, 42, bends forward in a slight bow and then flaps his arms slowly, like wings. "Hey, girl, what you think?" he coos. Walnut has heard that line before. The stately bird ignores Crow, reshuffles her storm-gray cloud wings, and snakes her head gracefully toward the ground, looking for something tasty to eat. "Come on now," Crow says. The zookeeper grabs a fistful of grass and tosses it into the air. This is Crow's sexiest move, a sly reference to building a nest together. Walnut looks up, curiosity glinting in her marigold eyes, but then she returns to probing the soft, wet ground with her bark-colored bill. "Try getting in the van," Crow calls to me. I follow his suggestion, and almost immediately, Walnut starts responding to Crow's overtures. She returns his bows and then turns away from him and holds her wings loosely away from her body. Kneeling behind the bird, Crow rests a hand gently on her back. Then he starts rubbing her thighs rhythmically, almost pornographically. 30 seconds elapse before Walnut steps away from Crow, fixes a few out-of-place feathers, and then stretches out her wings, asking for another go-round. In past years, Crow would have taken this opportunity to inject Walnut with a syringe of crane semen. Alas, a matchmaker in Memphis The keeper of the white-naped crane stud book, whose job is to ensure a genetically diverse captive population, has decreed that they don't need any more babies from Walnut, at least not this year. But that doesn't stop Crow and Walnut from going through all the motions all summer long, 5 days a week, sometimes several times a day. It's not exactly fun for me, but it keeps Walnut happy, Crow says. More to the point, this strange cross-species seduction has helped ensure that white-naped cranes continue to exist. Walnut arrived at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, the SCBI, an endangered species breeding center in Fort Royal, Virginia, back in 2004. She was the most genetically valuable white-naped crane in captivity. At 23, she had yet to produce a single chick, and she had a reputation for murdering her mates. Two male cranes that made amorous overtures toward Walnut had been found dead, with their bellies sliced open by her sharp claws. That, at least, was the rumor. Walnut hatched on July 2, 1981, in an old horse barn at the International Crane Foundation, ICF, in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Her parents, Mercury and Amazon, were wild-caught birds, captured illegally in China and smuggled to Hong Kong. The two cranes were probably en route to a private menagerie, or perhaps a taxidermist. Instead, they were intercepted by local authorities and eventually shipped to the ICF. This kind of poaching is less common today, but the white-naped crane population is falling because of a more relentless foe. Booming human populations overtaking, polluting, or draining the wetlands the birds need to survive. In addition to demanding as much as several hundred acres of wilderness for a single pair of cranes, these difficult birds seem drawn to marginal places. For instance, one of the white-naped crane's most important wintering grounds is the 2.5-mile-wide demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. As conservationists work to persuade people to preserve land for cranes, zoos are pursuing a parallel strategy. They are breeding captive white-naped cranes, creating an insurance population ready to be reintroduced should their wild counterparts disappear. But the problem with captive populations of animals is they tend to get inbred, which is why, in 1981, keepers were thrilled to have the genes of Mercury and Amazon to add to the mix. The two wowed ICF staff with their exuberant courtship displays, running, bowing, leaping, and trumpeting their love for each other all summer long. That year, they produced 9 chicks, including Walnut. These wobbly baby birds were raised in small herds, minded by so-called chick mamas who fed them, cleaned their pens, and took them out to a horse ring for daily exercise, and to a baby pool for swimming lessons. The chick mamas were mostly volunteers, said Joan Fordham, a former ICF employee. Fordham's 10-year-old daughter was a chick mama one summer, and she apparently didn't get a lot of training. If the cranes started fighting, she knew how to separate them, and that was pretty much it, Fordham recalls. The danger of hand-rearing crane chicks, however, is the possibility that they may imprint on humans. When it's time to find a suitable mate, some human-imprinted cranes seek out a partner that looks like their presumed parent, a human, instead of another bird. This, it seems, is what happened with Walnut. Bridging a 320 million year evolutionary divide, Walnut likely made some human fall in love with her. This relationship, however well-meaning, doomed Walnut to a life of loneliness. Cranes, which mate for life, are happiest when housed in pairs. Walnut was transferred to the Denver Zoo and then to the Cincinnati Zoo, but keepers were never able to find her a mate. In October 2004, Walnut was transferred to SCBI for one last chance at motherhood. The Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute sprawls across 3,200 acres of rolling hills near Shenandoah National Park. There, far from the noisy crowds that pour through its sister institution, the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., members of 21 threatened or endangered species are busy having babies, making their kinds a little less rare. As winter shaded into spring, Carol Hesch, assistant curator at the Memphis Zoo and keeper of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums White-naped Crane Stud Book, consulted a genetic database and determined that Walnut should be bred with Ray, a comely male crane 2 yards over. Ray, however, was already paired with Abigail. If they tried to put Walnut and Ray together, feathers would fly, so to speak. So the plan was to use artificial insemination, a stressful procedure that requires capturing the birds and holding them down for minutes at a time. One day that March, Crow and Warren Lynch, a fellow zookeeper at SCBI, entered Walnut's cage and herded her into a corner. The moment Walnut looked away, Lynch grabbed her body underneath her wings. Then he stepped over the bird and held her between his legs, facing backward. Kneeling behind her, Crow began massaging Walnut's cloaca, an all-purpose orifice that birds use for defecation as well as reproduction, and applied gentle pressure to her back, mimicking the weight of a male crane. Walnut purred, her cloaca open, and Crow injected semen that the two zookeepers had collected in much the same way from Ray. A few weeks later, Walnut laid 2 fertilized eggs, which Crow stole and placed in Ray and Abigail's nest. That was necessary because in the wild, cranes take turns incubating their eggs, and Crow didn't want Walnut to shoulder that burden alone. "It's just too much for her," he says, "and I don't want to sit on it myself." Plus, it was becoming clear to Crow that Walnut did not see herself as a crane and might not recognize baby cranes as her own. In fact, one young male crane with a clear view of Walnut was always trying to get her attention, with head bobs and calls. Walnut wasn't having any of it. That summer, however, Crow noticed that Walnut seemed interested in, well, him. When Crow stopped by her yard, she would bow her head and raise her wings, motions that Crow now recognizes as the first moves of a mating dance. "At first, I thought she was just excited to see me," Crow says, "but then I'd see the other pairs doing the same things, and it kind of dawned on me." Crow accepted Walnut's invitation to dance. Though he felt a little silly, he bobbed his head when Walnut bobbed hers and raised and lowered his arms like wings. The two circled each other, and sometimes Walnut would make a loud trumpeting sound, the beginning of the white-naped crane love duet. If no one was around, Crow would try to do the male part of the song, making a Homer Simpson-like woo-hoo. But Walnut never found his efforts satisfactory. As the weather cooled, so did Walnut's ardor. But in the spring, Walnut began greeting her keeper with bows again. This gave Crow an idea. If Walnut thought he was her mate, maybe Crow could make that year's artificial insemination less stressful for both of them. "If we could get her able to do it without catching her, there's no stress, no risk of injury," Crow says. "It's much better for us and for the crane." So Crow started training her to tolerate his touch. Reaching his arm out slowly, he'd graze Walnut's tail feathers with his fingertips and then immediately reward her with a dead mouse, Walnut's favorite treat. Eventually, Walnut allowed Crow to pet her entire back and seemed to enjoy it, purring like a contented cat. One day, after some petting, Walnut turned away from Crow, extended her wings, and raised her tail, an invitation to mate. Walnut was asking Crow to flutter to her back and perform what's poetically known as a cloacal kiss. Crow recalls being both startled and amused. "It's what I had been working toward and hoping for, but it was still surprising when it happened," he said. Composing himself, Crow put a hand on Walnut's back and then rubbed her thighs, going through the motion motions of artificial insemination. Once the two got their routine down, in March 2007, Crowe and Lynch captured Ray and collected semen, and then Crowe injected it into Walnut by himself, with her willing participation. Walnut and Crowe would go on to produce 5 chicks this way, a major boon for the captive white-naped crane population, Lynch says. That also means Walnut's rare genes are no longer in danger of dying with her. Crowe is proud of his groundbreaking work with cranes, but he admits that sometimes the whole project feels futile. White-naped cranes are continuing to decline in the wild, and many other species appear headed toward extinction. The heart of the matter, it seems, is that most people don't share Crowe's conviction that animals are thinking, feeling individuals, that they have just as legitimate a claim on this planet as we humans do. How do we bridge the ever-widening gap that separates us from the environment, other animals, and even one another? Maybe Crowe and Walnut are demonstrating, and my apologies to the Beatles, that all you need is love. After all, what ultimately drives even the most scientific, tough-minded conservation efforts is an irrational, big-hearted embrace of a wilderness that's coldly indifferent to us, an impossible connection we feel to animals that we can never truly understand. All this time, we heavy-headed primates assumed our brains held all the solutions, but maybe our hearts can be the better guide. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And we'll move on over to the Talking Points page. This article is U.S. versus China, a widening power struggle. A full-blown U.S.-China trade war is now a reality, said David Lake and Jessica Chen Weiss in the Washington Post. The Trump administration slapped tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese goods this week, and as expected, China responded with $60 billion in reciprocal tariffs. President Trump believes he can so badly damage China's export-dependent economy with tariffs that the Chinese will bow to his demands to import more American goods, reduce the trade deficit, and thus bring back some lost American jobs. But China is unlikely to cave in and will seek new markets for its exports and replace U.S. imports with its own products. Trade is just the pretext for a wider struggle over economic, military, and technological superiority, said Andrew Brown in Bloomberg.com. Chinese leaders once viewed Trump as a pragmatic businessman, but now they see a U.S. president moving toward containment of an ascendant competitor on the global stage. They're not far off the mark. When Trump started down the path 6 months ago, said Veronique Durugi in NationalReview.com, he told us that trade wars are good and easy to win. We were promised other countries wouldn't retaliate against our tariffs because we are a huge market and they can't afford to cut themselves off from it. We were assured tariffs would force China to end bad trade practices, and that American workers and consumers would feel little pain. But all of these have already been proved wrong. More than 32,000 angry U.S. firms have filed requests for Trump to exempt them from tariffs on products they need, and the prices of steel, washing machines, and cars are rising fast. If that's winning, then I would like a little less winning, please. Trump is right to see China as a rival, said WashingtonExaminer.com in an editorial, but trying to browbeat the Chinese into total submission will only backfire. The browbeating is about to get worse, said Jonathan Swan in Axios.com. The Trump administration's national security team reportedly plans to launch a major rhetorical and substantive broadside against China over the next few weeks. The White House will present evidence of malign activity by the Chinese government in U.S. affairs, including cyber attacks, election interference, and intellectual property theft. "We're not just going to let Russia be the boogeyman," said one White House official. "It's Russia and China." And we'll finish out the show with some shorter notes, as we often do. Nearly half of all cell phone calls will be from scammers by next year, according to a report by First Orion, which provides caller ID and call blocking services for major cell carriers. The number of fraudulent calls increased from 3.7% of total calls in 2017 to 29.2% in 2018, and is expected to jump to 44.6% by early 2019. President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, has met multiple times with special counsel Robert Mueller's investigators, according to people familiar with the talks. Mueller's team reportedly asked Cohen questions about Trump's business dealings with Russia, including an attempt during the 2016 presidential campaign to get a Trump Tower built in Moscow. 5 million Americans were living with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias in 2014, representing about 1.6% of the U.S. population. That number is projected to grow to 13.9 million, nearly 3.3% of the population, by 2060. The Trump administration has lowered the number of refugees allowed into the country from 45,000 last year to 30,000. In 2016, the Obama administration's refugee cap was 110,000. Baby boomers age 55 to 64 are slightly more likely to smoke pot on a monthly basis than young people ages 12 to 17, according to a new federal drug use study. And we will finish out with a quote. This comes from physician William Osler, quoted in the Toronto Sun. He says, "Only the doctor who has the disease really understands it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.